I've studied the form of comics intimately. I believe comics are our last link to an ancient way of passing on history. The Egyptians drew on walls. Countries all over the world still pass on knowledge through pictorial forms. I believe comics are a form of history that someone somewhere felt or experienced. Characters in comics are often attributed special powers, invisibility, X-ray vision, things of that sort. It's an exaggeration of the truth. Maybe it's based on something as simple as instinct. It's hard for many to believe there are extraordinary things inside themselves as well as others. I hope you can keep an open mind.
What I am questioning is your belief that you are something more than human.
And yet, it is true.
Welcome to Now Playing's M. Night Shyamalan East Rail 177 series.
They say this one has a surprise ending.
Part of Now Playing's M. Night Shyamalan movie thriller series.
He's done awful things to people and he'll do awful things to you.
Hosted by Arnie.
You are different from the rest. The broken are the more evolved.
Stuart.
That sounds like the bad guys teaming up.
And Jacob.
The three of you've convinced yourselves you have extraordinary gifts, like something out of a comic book.
As our way of thanking you for your support of Now Playing, we are pleased to provide you this bonus podcast.
Are you trying to trick me, etc.? I'll tell on you.
This podcast contains detailed plot spoilers and harsh language.
It's all right to be afraid, David, because this part won't be like a comic book.
Listener discretion is advised.
Are you ready?
Tonight, we're talking Split, starring James McAvoy, Anya Taylor-Joy, Betty Buckley, directed by M. Night Shyamalan. This is the Now Playing co-host who's done terrible things to people, and I'll do terrible things to this movie, Arnie.
Ed Stewart.
My name's Jacob. I have wet socks. I have blue socks too, etc.
Applause for a good impersonation.
Is it, or is it just a accurate representation of this movie?
I remember seeing James McAvoy do that voice in the trailer. I'm like, M. Night, you've done it again. Another magnificent failure.
I know. I was so excited about Split. Confession. I, as the one that supposedly never misses his films, didn't go to this one. I skipped out on Split for a couple reasons. One, I was preparing to leave Los Angeles in a few months, and if it wasn't a movie for Now Playing, I usually didn't make time for it. But two, yeah, this got good reviews. I don't need that. Who's got time for that? If M. Night's gonna come, he better bring the happening. He better put us back in the water with the lady. I want to see his ego. I don't want to see his movie.
I saw a trailer for this back in 2015, and it was one of those situations where I'm sitting in the movie theater watching a trailer, not knowing what movie it is, and I see James McAvoy. I have wet socks, and I have blue socks.
And then he shows up in drag. Like, oh, it's amazing.
I'm like, oh boy, what is this? And then I see from M. Night Shyamalan, and I'm like, oh no, not McAvoy. I like McAvoy. No, what have you done to McAvoy? I thought for sure this was going to be an embarrassment, and I'm like, McAvoy can go through it. McAvoy can live through it. I was really worried for him. Then, damn it, the second trailer came, and they hit a sweet spot for me. It made it look like a movie that I haven't seen in a while. In the 90s, it felt like there were a lot of these kidnap killer movies. I think Silence of the Lambs kicked it off, but Kiss the Girls, The Vanishing, Vacancy, Don't Say a Word, Funny Games, kind of. The closest I could come up with lately was the beginning of Human Centipede had that vibe. And I was like, so James McAvoy is a multiple personality who's kidnapped people to kill them? That sounds like it could be a good thriller. And the more I saw of McAvoy, the more I'm like, I think he might pull it off.
Plus, it's coming out in January. There's no competition. I think it was up against XXX Part 2.
3, actually.
Oh, right.
The Return of Xander Cage.
That's right.
The second one with Vin Diesel. Forget about that Ice Cube one.
Well, I didn't go to theaters for this, but when it hit video on demand, I bought it like the weekend it came out. I didn't even wait for rental. I bought it and we went in the home theater, put up the dogs, put away the phones. We're having the theater experience at home and I watched it.
And is that because it was James McAvoy or because the trailer sold you?
The trailer sold me on the kidnapping thing. Again, like Loved Ones or Along Came a Spider or Don't Say a Word. You know, this is a genre of movie, the thriller that I like.
And frankly, it was a genre that went out of fashion with The Sixth Sense. Sixth Sense made it more trendy to have ghost stories and serial killer stories went away. So this is M. Night actually bringing back a genre he killed.
So that was what got me first and foremost. But yeah, McAvoy, I've seen a lot of stuff that I wouldn't have seen because McAvoy's name was on it these days. And he does not always pick good projects. Victor Frankenstein, not recommend.
You saw it?
I only saw it because it had McAvoy.
He's in it?
I had no idea you were such a fan of him. I mean, to me, he's in that caliber of actor that can, yeah, exactly, be in something good or bad, that he might usually be an asset, but no sign of the ultimate quality.
He's just usually really good in roles, and he tends to pick interesting projects. I mean, outside of X-Men, I liked him in Atomic Blonde quite a bit. Someday, I hope we get to talk Wanted, which is a comic book movie we haven't covered. There's still a few of those left. He just picks interesting projects, and then every so often, there's crap. But here, I was curious, could McAvoy make a turd from a Shyamalan float?
And I had many opportunities to catch up with this, but I think I knew by the time I was settled here in Springfield that we were eventually going to one day cover this franchise. So I intentionally just left this one off. I figured I won't do it. I didn't know much about it. I knew what the trailer told me, which is that, yeah, it's a abductor of women who has multiple personalities, and maybe some of those personalities could help the women escape while other personalities are keeping them captive. And I eventually did know that it was tied to Unbreakable. That came much, much later. But I think ultimately anyone that's going to see the film now knows that this is part two of the Israel 177 trilogy.
Yeah, I have never seen this until watching it for this recording, but that piece of news I felt like got out pretty quick that, oh, he has created a superhero universe. Hey, remember that Unbreakable film no one likes? It's an underrated film, I feel, but now that is like the backbone to M. Night's cinematic legacy. This is what he's creating his franchise on.
And fortunately, I went into this unspoiled. I intentionally avoided all information about Split, and honestly, it wasn't that hard. Nobody I knew, either in person or online, went to see this in theaters, and one of the reasons I did rush for video on demand is I knew M. Night usually had a twist. I didn't want anything spoiled, but even before this movie hit theaters, I'd seen some rumors that Bruce Willis was going to cameo as David Dunn, but I didn't know for sure until I actually watched the film at the very end. I'm like, I've heard it might happen, kind of like Sam Jackson at the end of Iron Man. I'm like, I've heard Sam Jackson might show up at the end of Iron Man, but you just don't know until you're in the theater.
It's not a property you would think that people would want to go back to 15 years later. And again, I think it is a recommendable Shyamalan movie. It's one of the few I've given a green arrow to unironically. But I do think it's really strange to pick up that thread. I think they made a movie with the intention it could stand alone, and with this little, I would almost call it an Easter egg. The fact that Bruce Willis is going to pop up is almost like, well, if you happen to remember that movie.
Yeah, this should be an end credits scene, except no one's going to stay through the credits for this because they're not expecting it.
Yeah, this thing, I think, became a success not because it was building on the 15 years of anticipation, but because it connected with audiences, young people now, people not old enough to enjoy Unbreakable when it came out. This was a huge hit. It made about $140 million in the United States alone on a $9 million budget. Blumhouse threw a little bit more coin tonight after the visit, but not much more. This was still low budget. He wasn't able to use the cameraman and the composer that he normally does. He had to go on the cheap, get the guy that did It Follows.
I'm surprised this is the cheap because I think this is a pretty beautiful looking film, if nothing else.
Well, this again, from his commencement speech, this was what M. Night did with all of his profits from The Visit. He self-funded this again. And since we're talking about the Eastrail trilogy, he did have one big hurdle. David Dunn and Mr. Glass and everything in the Unbreakable universe is the property of Walt Disney. And Disney was not going to work with M. Night anymore. M. Night was self-funding. He'd partnered with Blum for distribution. But to get Dunn in here, and especially to make Glass, required both studios to agree that he could utilize the characters and do that. So the fact that Bruce Willis may or may not have shown up may have as much been a lawyer type thing of talking about what M. Night's allowed to use as much as anything. But yes, Glass coming out is the most amazing thing. We haven't seen it since Who Framed Roger Rabbit? Disney characters interacting with non-Disney characters.
Yeah, the point that M. Night has a franchise, that he's still making films, that is his biggest twist.
It means there must be something here. If McAvoy didn't work, there's no reason to go back to David Dunn. So I was curious to finally to reach this space and find out what all the hype was about Split.
This was an idea he had had since Unbreakable. In his early treatments for Unbreakable, he had David Dunn going up against the Horde, this multiple personality beast creature. And he thought it was way too much to put in, and he'd kind of tucked it away for an Unbreakable sequel. And when he was looking for his follow-up to The Visit, he dusted that character off and said, you know, I think this is still a really interesting character. I think I can do a story with him, even without David Dunn, but I will make it in the same universe, just in case. So what we get next week when we review Glass, I can't believe it's finally here. It's January. I'm just not used to January movies, but we're getting the culmination of his vision since the early 2000s. It's taken him nearly 20 years.
So let's see where he's headed. Arnie, give him the plot.
James McAvoy plays Kevin Wendell Crum, a man whose childhood abuse has left him afflicted with a multiple personality disorder. By the help of his doctor, Karen Fletcher, played by Betty Buckley, Kevin's 23 personalities have been quelled, and the dominant personality, a fashion designer named Barry, has been in control. But what's being hid from Dr. Fletcher is that Barry has been overthrown by two more evil personalities. The first is Dennis, a violent man who has a penchant for underage girls. Then there's stern and British Patricia. And they were given control thanks to the personality of Hedwig, who believes himself to be a 9-year-old boy. He was tired of the other personalities making fun of him, so he let Dennis and Patricia take over. Dennis then stalks and kidnaps three high school girls: Claire, played by Haley Lou Richardson, Marcia, played by Jessica Sula, and reclusive Casey, played by Anya Taylor-Joy. It turns out these three are to be sacrificed to Kevin's 24th personality, known as the Beast. The girls try various means of escape from their underground dungeon, and that makes up about an hour of the film, but they're always stopped by Dennis or Patricia. As a result of their escape attempts, the three girls are locked in different areas of the basement. Dr. Fletcher does realize Barry has been suppressed by Dennis, so she goes to the lair where the girls are kidnapped, but she's captured by Dennis also. Then it turns out all the insanity the personalities have spouted is true. Kevin can turn into the Beast, which changes him physically, giving him enhanced strength to the point he can even crawl on walls. The Beast kills Dr. Fletcher, then kills and eats Claire and Marcia. He's about to eat Casey, but then he sees scars on her body. For most of Casey's life, she's been sexually and physically abused by her uncle, who's also her guardian. The Beast says he only wants to rid the world of the, quote, untouched, meaning people who have never suffered. So he leaves Casey alone and runs away. Casey escapes to find out she's been in the catacombs underneath the Philadelphia Zoo where Kevin had worked. Meanwhile, the police are on the lookout for the cannibalistic killer, and due to his many personalities, the media have nicknamed him The Horde. Watching this news program is Unbreakable David Dunn, played by Bruce Willis, and The Horde fantasizes about how they will change the world as credits roll. I did a lot of preamble talking, but what this movie is a thriller. If I did my plot summary in the way the movie goes, we start with the three girls, they get kidnapped, and then throughout the movie, they tease out the information about all of Kevin's personalities.
As M. Night is wont to do, like, it's always a slow burn.
And yet, I think anyone watching this film, because of the advertisements, they're going to know what is going on with our main character. Split, the title might not totally tell you that this is about dissociative identity disorder. It takes about 35 minutes before that technical term is used in the film. But if you saw a trailer for this film, you know that the guy that gets in the car and abducts these girls is only one of many personalities being played by James McAvoy.
And the setup for these girls is really pretty standard. You know, I feel bad because I think Claire and Marcia don't get that much definition. They're high school friends, and it's Claire's birthday. She invited everyone from her class. She didn't want to invite Casey because Casey's the weird girl, but she's a nice enough girl that she didn't want to exclude only Casey because there's no way Casey wouldn't find out. So when the movie starts, the birthday party's ended and they find they have to give Casey a ride home because her uncle's truck is broken down. That's why these unlikely trio are together, two friends and one outcast.
That was spoiled because I saw the trailer and they kind of told you the premise, but I think this is good visual storytelling that creates some suspense. Why is the food on the floor? And it's just felt so long since I've seen M. Night do something like this.
Not to mention, I think that he's tapping into something that feels very true about our world. We're so sucked up into whatever is on our phone that we can miss big stuff. You know, like, I think that's something I've seen a few directors play with. These girls are in the back seat watching something on their phone. They miss that their dad is being gassed behind them in the trunk. They don't even notice that it's not him in the driver's seat for a beat. It really takes a long while for people to wake up. And that was some of the cutscenes from this film. It was more at the birthday party at the restaurant. It kind of emphasized the fact that only our main character, Casey, is aware of her surroundings. Everyone else is bumping into each other and taking selfies and just tuned out from the larger picture.
Again, the storytelling here, at least it's really strong in the beginning, I feel like. Because, yeah, you see Casey, she is sitting there looking at Kevin, I guess we'll call him. I mean, he's Dennis at this point, but just for clarity's sake, I'll just call him Kevin, unless we need to identify whoever he's playing. But James McAvoy is Kevin. He's sitting there. She's looking at him. I'm like, why isn't she getting out and running? Because he sprays the other two girls with whatever gas or mace or whatever he has. But he kind of just sits there and she's looking there. And I'm like, okay, why isn't she trying to get away? And then slowly she moves to the door. And then that door alarm dings. I think the tension's really good. Right away, it's setting up mysteries. I'm like, okay, what is the deal with Casey? Why isn't she more into self-preservation? Why isn't she trying to get away?
I kind of took it. I don't know how much I believe it. But you hear the phrase paralyzed with fear because she has a tear rolling down her cheek. That's what I get. But why isn't Kevin gassing her? You know, he's not going to know that she's docile. He gasses the other two and then he looks like he's preparing to drive off. I'm like, does he not see the person in the passenger seat?
Well, my initial take on this story was maybe she's in on it. Again, she has this really lame excuse about her ride can't come and they're trapped into driving her home. For a second, I think that the twist may be that she's in cahoots. But then, of course, she's gassed too. But the reason why he's not looking at her, it said later he was only following the other two. He never saw her. He was not stalking her, but for 4 days, he looked at the birthday girl and her friend and decided they were prey for the beast.
Okay, I did miss that line, but I'm there with you, Stuart. I did wonder, oh, is the twist going to be that Casey has this disorder too? There's lots of little things that are hinted at, which, again, I feel like, oh, this is a mystery that's pulling me in, which I haven't felt for many films with M. Night.
And I'll give the credits a little bit of credit, no pun intended. The way that they split all the titles and you get 20 some odd of each of them small and then it goes big. M. Night has wanted to be the new Spielberg, but it seemed like a Hitchcockian opening credits touch.
It feels more dangerous than Night has ever been, honestly. I mean, even his R-rated Happening. Yeah, he might have killed a few people brutally, but by and large, Night is someone that wants to coddle our inner child and is always crafting these morals about how we should grow up and live our lives. He doesn't really like to terrify, and there is something just very unsettling and terrifying about this abduction. It shows remarkable restraint from sentimentality. I would not have guessed that the maker of any of the previous films, including Sixth Sense, would have the sensibilities to make an opening like this.
And this is the movie I expected, and I'm really into it. I want to know more about the abductor. I want to know where these girls are. This is a movie I've seen a dozen times. I know these girls are going to try to escape, and some may not. I don't know if we're going to follow a cop who may be trying to rescue them, played by Morgan Freeman. But I was very much into this scenario, even if the girls are pretty generic. And other than Casey, I think those other two never get beyond stock character.
What's going for them is I like the actresses. I've actually seen the one that's playing Claire. She was in a nice little indie film called Columbus where she starred. She had the whole movie and she's capable of it. I mean, I think maybe a mistake Knight makes is telling you too early who the main character is. By singling out Casey, she's always alone. She has all these flashbacks to, you know, being 5 years old in a hunting trip. We know to only pay attention to her. He could have done more work with these characters, but they're at least likable. We understand them as the contrast to Casey, who's passive, who wants to hang back and just wait and see what happens. We kind of would be more on the side of Claire, who, because she took some kickboxing class, feels like she's got to fight back. And it's interesting. This is where I really see Casey is like her abductor. She resents these girls for thinking that they're in control. She resents them for being so innocent and naive. And I think that is the mentality, at least as M. Night would define it, of a survivor of abuse. That they look at people that haven't been abused with contempt. How dare you think you know how the world works?
It's an interesting plight that these three girls have strife that I don't feel gets played to the fullest, though, because there's not a whole lot of interaction between them. Pretty soon, it does not take me long to realize the star of this movie isn't Casey, it's Kevin. And I thought I was watching a movie about an abducted girl trying to outsmart and escape from her abductor. But what I'm really seeing is a movie that's going to be an actor's wet dream, right? You get to be 24 people in the same movie. Go.
Yeah, and it's well known that this wasn't supposed to be McAvoy. They had Joaquin Phoenix lined up to come back and do it, and Joaquin was doing interesting work again. I mean, he kind of had a bad spell there, too, in the late 2000s there, where he was the rapper, whatever his alternate identity rap star career was, where he was high on drugs most of the time. He didn't do a lot of good movies after Walk the Line, but had started come back and do more interesting projects like Her, and I think, ultimately, that was the downfall. He had too many other good scripts he could do. I don't need to do Knight. And when he dropped out, McAvoy just happened to be available. I had to take the part pretty quickly.
M. Night talked about this again at the commencement speech. He was really depressed. He's like, who can do this role? He thought only Joaquin could play the 24 people. And he was at San Diego Comic-Con and literally bumped into McAvoy backstage, like had to excuse himself for not looking. And then from that meeting, he got thinking and he's like, James McAvoy would be great in this role. And it turned out that he could do it. The shaved head isn't just the shaved head of evil as they have in the movie tropes, but it's because he had just come off of Days of Future Past. He was still shaven-headed Professor X.
Yeah, I like McAvoy here. I don't know how seriously he's taken, but he has a lot of fun. Every time a different personality comes out, yeah, it looks like it'd be a fun role to play if you had that in you.
Yeah, we have enough time with him first as the abductor. Again, pretend you don't know that there's going to be multiple personalities. Yeah, you might just think he's a skinhead. He's very, very severe. And then it's really Casey who first notices his OCD and his need for cleanliness. She advises one of the girls to pee on herself as a way of protecting herself when he drags her out of the room, because we don't know what he's capable of. It turns out he only wants to dance with her, but he also doesn't like germs. And so by peeing on herself, she's thrown back into the room.
And that is a hell of a move. I was kind of proud. You don't see movies going there that often, but that's actually something I've recently heard is women, if you are being assaulted sexually, pee yourself, defecate yourself, make yourself completely unwantable in that way to have the attacker move on.
So that's not just because he had OCD.
In this movie, it is, but I've since seen it as a self-defense mechanism for women as a last line of defense against sexual assault.
Interesting. Good little tip there. We're in an educational podcast as well. But I think by 15 minutes, we know at least this guy has a twin, because all of a sudden, someone that looks exactly like James McAvoy is going to see his shrink, and he's calling himself Barry.
It's actually Dennis playing Barry, but this may be my favorite of the personalities. I know nothing about fashion, so the terms he's dropping about all of these clothes he's designing mean nothing to me. But just as into it as he is, and as whimsical as he's playing it, and I kind of like the tentativeness that McAvoy brings, in that you're seeing Dennis pretending to be Barry, not comfortable in the Barry role. It's just a small thing, you know, and the doctor kind of calls it out, because Dennis is OCD and here he is adjusting the ashtray.
One thing I'm wondering, after completing the film, we're told at least the Dennis character was created by Kevin to protect him from his abusive mom. That's where all these personalities come from. And look, I don't want to get into the truth of all the psychology in this film, because I don't think this is how it actually plays out. But once they reveal that, I'm like, okay, so how are all these different characters? Like, I don't know what role Barry, like how he protected Kevin, but I do love Barry, the fashion designer. And again, I think James McAvoy is having a lot of fun here. Like, there's a Jade, I think, later on, and I thought that was Barry. There's some of these personalities aren't that distinctive, but it's fun to see McAvoy playing these different roles.
I was keeping a list of the personalities as we found them, and was actually disappointed how few we actually see. We really focus on Barry, Dennis, Patricia, Hedwig, and the Beast, and there's a couple video clips of others.
I think there's a reason why they do 23. Because I agree, why say he has 23 if you're only going to meet 8 of them? But think about pairs of human chromosomes, right? He's trying to get to that number. We, as human beings, we have 23 chromosome pairs, and the idea of emerging a 24th personality is kind of getting to the idea of becoming superhuman and having a 24th chromosome as well. We don't need all those personalities. You can freeze frame on a still of his computer and see the names of all of them listed in order, but I think you're right. Only a few matter for the telling of this story. It would be too hard to try and incorporate all of them into this story. But the reason to go big is because Knight has a lot to say about really potential and genetics and human evolution.
A choice that I really like is that each of the personalities comes with a wardrobe change. That makes it a little bit easier. Actors love props, right? You know, they like to have something to play off of. And so when Dennis as Barry goes to see the doctor, the knit cap, the red outfit, everything trying to look a little bit more fashionable, the way Patricia wears the dress. I like that McAvoy is playing this in such a way that, like you said, Stuart, I hadn't thought about it before, because I came into this movie knowing the premise, but McAvoy could be playing quadruplets that are just identical, and with the different wardrobe, the different mannerisms, the different accents, make me believe that they're different people.
DID is a pretty controversial diagnosis anyway. It's done far more often in movies than it's ever been recorded in real life. And so I am curious to see how much is Knight going to stick with what's known about it. I actually find maybe the most interesting character to be Dr. Karen Fletcher. Betty Buckley back and looking so much better than she did banging her head in The Happening here.
Well, no one's trying to take her lemon drink now. I agree, though. I really like Karen Fletcher in this film, because she feels like she's actually respecting Kevin here and saying, yeah, you have this and let's treat these. And she feels like an advocate instead of someone that's skeptical. You know, that was the whole tension with The Sixth Sense, was the skeptical psychologist. Here, she's worked with him and, you know, they'll use her to get out a lot of the exposition. But I like their interactions between Kevin and Karen.
I think Knight agrees with her. The difference is, many times when we see doctors on screen, science teachers even, I feel like M. Knight pushing back and creating stories where they're taught a lesson. Here, I think Knight agrees with Karen, because what Karen advocates is what he advocates, that you can find a plausible way to the supernatural. Karen wants to say, she's got this whole thesis she wants to lay out on the University of France that she Skypes 30 minutes into this film. If you believe that you have a different personality, you can physically manifest different traits. You can become stronger. You can have different diseases.
Yeah, this is some of that M. Night bullshit.
You know what? It has a credibility to it. I do like that one of Kevin's personalities we see in the video is like, if we're not different people, why do I need this? It's apparently diabetic, needing insulin. But here's where I go with this is through hypnosis, people have been able to have surgery without anesthesia. Through hypnosis, there have been scientifically documented cases of people being able to control their own bleeding out of a wound. So, if the mind can keep the body in states where you don't need anesthesia for surgery or you can choose not to bleed, then the rest of this could also be possible.
I believe in the placebo effect, that people can believe something's working, and so yeah, maybe they don't feel the pain. I don't believe that you have a personality that once you go into that, your pancreas dies and now you need to take insulin, and then you switch personalities and your pancreas comes back to life. I'm never going to buy that.
Yeah, that is fantasy, and don't buy that if someone tries to sell you that. Until it can be documented by real scientists, I refuse to believe that as science, but this is a night fantasy, and you know, I'll go with it.
What I'm saying is suspension of disbelief. It has enough basis in reality that I can roll with it, unlike a Narf and a grass dog and an eagle and a Groot.
Right.
Well, yeah, they're not saying stupid words to explain it, so maybe that's why I'm going along with it. Again, this is multiple personality disorder through the lens of Hollywood, which is never realistic, but this is such a trope, I'm not going to get that upset about, and I do like all the time we spend learning about it. Like, it does feel like M. Night thought about, okay, why would he develop this? Oh, because of this abuse, and he wants to be protected, and so interesting things come out of this bullshit diagnosis.
And I do think Betty Buckley is also very good in this. She had other scenes, and at one point when this movie was 3 hours long, she had a whole subplot where she had a romance with her neighbor who was a neuroscientist, and they kept having more and more dialogues about placebo effect and would he date her because he was a much younger man. It's played by Sterling K. Brown, who is on This Is Us. Strange combo, I know, but the scenes are actually charming as deleted scenes on the Blu-ray.
Was there ever a deleted scene of M. Night going to Hooters to buy those wings?
No, but he did work himself in there. I feel like I haven't seen him doing cameos in his films.
No, it's been a while.
But the fact is, as Karen wants to investigate whether, yes, there's an imposter in her DID, that when Barry, the extroverted fashion designer, comes, that there's something just a little bit too obvious on the nose about his need to be clean, that she actually suspects it might be another personality that knows about it.
You guys seem pretty high on Dr. Fletcher. I could use a lot less of her, to be honest, especially the Skyping of what looks like one person, but it's supposedly a big speech. The way she talks about it, I expected her to be on a podium. It looks like she might have been talking to her granddaughter the way that it looked, but there's just a bit too much of her. I get what M. Night is doing, and I get it more on the second viewing here. They have to set up the plausibility that he'll turn into a beast at the end. They got to give us all these physiological reasons here, and you've got to have a person with a doctorate degree spouting all this at the beginning so that we can believe it at the end. But there's just too much of her, and I don't think she ever comes across credible as the savior. You know, again, and if I look at Kiss the Girls, Morgan Freeman is credible that if he can get the information, he can rescue a person. Here, I don't know exactly what Dr. Fletcher is going
to
do.
Oh, and see, I never went into this as a rescue the enslaved girls. To me, it was a horror thriller about girls that are kidnapped, and there's a crazy Hannibal Lecter-type serial killer.
Knight is still guilty of his hyperbolic dialogue. When she's there, yeah, Skyping the conference and saying things like, suffering could unlock the ultimate doorway to all that we call unknown. Like, this is not the way scientists talk.
Yeah, I have a lot of issues when we get into the psychology by the end, but I'll wait.
She would be booed off of that stage. They would cut off her phone line. But there was an audience for this bullshit that's not being backed up by support. And even a colleague is like, you have some footage of a dog treating someone differently when they're a different personality. That is not proof of what you're trying to say. She needs to prove it.
But this isn't her only DID patient. She's got like tons of them. And at first I thought, oh, is that a euphemism for all his different personalities? But no, it seems like this is her specialty. Like, she could get some science around this, get a study going, come up with some proof.
I'd like a study of the Philadelphia area to find out why there'd be so many of them right there.
Yeah, I feel like it's a mistake that her practice specializes in all my patients have DID. Even her neighbor is just like, well, why do you trust those people? We only need one. It would make it more special if she was focusing in on Kevin, and that was her whole thesis, and she needed his cooperation.
I'd even go if she was, like, flown in. Like, she was the expert who's come to work with Kevin, like a Sigmund Freud type thing. thing. Give her an accent. She's from a different country, but she's seen this before, and that's why she has the expertise on the physiological differences. But yeah, that there's all these people in Philadelphia with this, I just...
Yeah, the fact that she has all these patients led me to my theory that we're going to find out that Casey was one of them as well. And, like, she's going to have her beast come out to fight the beast at the end.
Yeah, well, they do draw parallels between the two. They're both victims of abuse, and how they respond to that is interesting. But that isn't where M. Night is going with this. Let's talk a little bit about the hierarchy, because we keep calling the main person Kevin. It's interesting that Kevin isn't the prime personality. The number one personality is Barry. Barry is the one that has the identity that goes out and goes to work, and everyone that he interacts with knows him as Barry. They may not know that he has multiple personalities. They just know that it's Barry. But he was born Kevin Wendell Crumb and developed Barry as a three-year-old when Mommy Dearest was chasing him around with a wire hanger.
No, he created Dennis as a three-year-old, the OCD one, because he would make a mess and the mom would get mad. So he created this OCD personality that would always clean up.
Then why is Dennis number eight? Because he has seven personalities, including his own, before he gets to Dennis. I thought Dennis was a tougher version that came later because the other ones weren't protective enough.
See, that is the problem, is they lead you to the idea that each of these personalities protected Kevin in some way. We're told why Dennis protected him. I don't know how Patricia protected him, Jade, Barry, all those other ones. Hedwig.
I think Hedwig makes sense because that shows regression. That shows I can't handle this. I think Hedwig is actually the one that come up with the idea of the beast. He has all the crayon drawings of the monster. He's probably the one that sells to the other ones that there could be such a character to protect them. That it has been left for Dennis to do. He's called the strongest one among them. He's certainly the most imposing, but he's no beast. And certainly in the end, he just seems more quirky than formidable.
And what I found interesting was, though, Barry may be the dominant personality, but what we're told is he gives everyone their chance, quote, in the light, meaning they are the ones in control for a while. So I don't know if he goes hour by hour, each person gets 1 hour a day, or how he could juggle 23 personalities being in control. But apparently they were in harmony for some degree of time until it was Hedwig who came along and became a disruptor.
Right. Hedwig is number 9. I assume that this is chronological, but he's number 9 of the 23. And he ultimately can disrupt Barry's power because he says what he wishes can come into being, that he can wish himself into the light and therefore take away the power from the parental figure, which is Barry. And so once this kid has the power in the spotlight and is spouting ideas about monsters and what have you, it gets the other two personalities that will be collectively known as the Horde. The Horde or the Outcast. There's really only 3 people that are the Horde of the 23.
One of the things they set up in this, which I like, that, you know, they don't show us it. I guess they could do some surrealist scene where you go inside of Kevin's head, but I kind of like how they explain this. That, yeah, everyone's sitting in that waiting room and they kind of wait for their turn to come out. But it is just the three, right? The three, Patricia, Dennis, and Hedwig, they're holding the rest like hostage because they want the beast to come out.
And they play loose with rules because I thought it was established that one doesn't know what the other one knows or thinks. And yet, clearly, there's some sharing. There's some collective agreement about whether the beast is a good or a bad idea, because Patricia is all in. She's the zealot that's pushing for the beast to come and to do whatever it takes. She's the one that really talked Dennis into abducting the girls and taking that step. She knew he had a weakness for young women because there had been an incident where some high school girls came up and made him cop a feel. And I think that that was a turning point.
We could have had this personified. They could have gone into his head, right? And you could have had CGI 23.
Yeah, Herman's head was a huge sitcom hit.
Identity. I mean, let's not do it.
Yeah, I'm just saying you could have had that. I wasn't thinking Herman's head. I was thinking, honestly, being John Malkovich when he goes into his own head, you know, having 23 McAvoys in there in various outfits. But yeah, there's something going on with this beast that's never been seen before. Apparently never been surfaced. Some of the personalities don't even believe in it.
Right. But that is what we're expected to believe the girls have been abducted for. Ultimately, they are virgin sacrifices for this alleged mythical 24th personality.
What I didn't really remember from the first viewing is that their food. Because Dennis wants to get a little frisky, and Patricia says, no, he's not to touch you. You're going to be food for the beast.
Well, yeah, and if Dennis does assault them, then they're no longer worthy of the beast, as we'll find out.
Yeah, we have one scene when the first girl, all three girls will make their attempt to escape. Claire is the first one. She's the feistiest, the birthday girl. She finds in the ceiling a grate that opens up into ductwork that looks like it'll lead somewhere, and it only leads her to a dead end and to a locker. She's quickly captured, and we worry, you know, this guy is like, your sweater is dirty, take it off, and skirts and shirts have to go. I'm like, oh, this is going to turn into sexual assault. We're actually very relieved. For a little bit, we perceive Patricia as a help because she steps in and says, no, these girls aren't here for that. They're here for another purpose. Notice all the characters are wearing yellow. We know that Knight loves his color theory. We saw in Sixth Sense that he dribbled red in there in order to signify contact with the ghost realm. Yellow was the protective color in the village. And it's also been known that in art theory and such. I mean, that's not just something Knight came up with. You will oftentimes see yellow used in that way. The sun, I think it's just, it goes along with that idea of healing.
I kept writing it down. I'm like, oh, there's yellow flowers and Dennis has a yellow handkerchief and Hedwig has yellow on his coat, but maybe this means something to M. Knight. It never means anything in this film.
They're all looking for protection. And again, yellow is a color that can mean that when you study color theory. You have to realize the motivation for all these characters, even the terrible things that they do, is that they're just trying to protect themselves and themselves as a collective. So there's no true enemy here except the beast. Ultimately, once we realize that sexual assault is off the table, we don't fear any of the personalities that come. We're only waiting in anticipation of the one that no one has seen.
Except Patricia and Dennis are the heavies. They're the goons. You know, what a majority of this movie is these girls attempting to escape, getting in the ceiling and whatnot. And if they could get out, Hedwig might be able to be fooled into letting them go. He's going to say he has a window.
I do like those moments that he has with Casey. Yeah, can you show me your room? Oh, come on. When he dances for Casey, bravo. Like, best scene of this film. Like, there's some of that crazy M. Night still in this movie. But yeah, I like that relationship Casey has with Hedwig. She's trying to play him, but she's also sympathetic. There is something off about her, and we'll find out throughout the film, but I'm always wondering what is going on with her. Why is she so passive when the other ones are so active?
Yeah, she tries to get out by seduction. She allows this little boy to have his first kiss, and she is going along flirtatiously. She is using sex. The other two girls are using aggression. When we see Marcia trying to get away in the kitchen, she picks up a chair and whacks Patricia. And again, she knows the door is locked, and yet she somehow thinks that she can find some door somewhere that will let her out into safety. But no, of course not. They're eventually all separated. But yes, what is interesting is that we have the two popular girls who believe in fighting, and then we have this other girl, she is the one that wasn't even supposed to be invited to the party, who seems to resent them for having that fighting spirit, who thinks that they're very naive and thinking that they can win against an aggressor. We will know, as it's dribbled out through her flashbacks, how she came to feel so helpless in victimization.
I got that almost from the very first flashback, though, the first time I watched it. When you see the bearded guy and everything calling to Casey, I'm like, oh boy, I do not want this movie to go deep into a description of young child molestation.
Oh, when they go to play animals in the woods, that was, to me, I'm like, ooh, I got it. We don't need to see that scene.
This is a PG-13 movie. It's not R. They don't show any nudity. They don't show anything too exploitive.
No, what they do to your mind, yeah, you always imagine something worse in your mind, so oof.
Yeah, and playing animals, this is in parallel to a character who is becoming an animal. I mean, we will ultimately see that she kind of agrees and is spared because she has the same mentality as our main character, this beast character. She's already lived with a beast. That one is coming is nothing new to her.
And the appeasement through seduction, if you've got a molester who's going to beat you and scar you and cut you if you resist, I hate to say it, but it could almost be self-preservation to go along with it.
But one of the flashbacks, she pulls a shotgun. Was it not loaded? Like, it's bothersome because this is a M. Night B movie about a guy who's becoming an indestructible serial killer. And now you're wanting to get into some deep psychology about child molestation. Just not the appropriate place for that. So I have troubles once that's kind of revealed and seeing how it's treated in this film. Not the place for that kind of story.
Midnight movies do this often. I feel like...
Here's the thing with midnight movies. I read from M. Night. He likes to take B movies and turn them into A movies. Thanks, M. Night.
Yeah.
With midnight movies, there is some kind of joy because they know that they're sleazy and exploitive and just B midnight movies. M. Night thinks he's doing something higher. This is a higher art, and I just don't think that's what he's really making.
I don't have a problem with it here, and that's not words I usually say about M. Night. I usually always have a problem with whatever he's attempting to do artistically. I think it's utilized just enough. You get the idea. There was a cut scene where she actually did try and tell her dad, and we see very clearly that she makes a choice not to do it, because that's kind of going on in your head, is like, the dad's on the hunting trip as well as this uncle. Where was he? Why doesn't he know? And that ultimately, when he's revealed to have died, was he murdered? Did this guy kill the guy in order to, like,
that's what I was wondering,
to get custody and take his prize? You know, he's viewed throughout the movie as someone that is always into the deer and their racks and all of that, so we think of her as a trophy that he might have been collecting. But I think we're legitimately to take that the dad just died of a heart attack. It wasn't foul play.
Yeah, I never thought the father was murdered, but I did think it was rather convenient that the father never found out about this abuse, and then when he did die, the abuser becomes the guardian. It's the scariest thing in this movie, is the because it has a reality to it that's just sickening.
Yeah, here's the trouble. Yes, this movie asks more than a traditional B movie by going to sexual predators and letting us really think of this in terms of our main character who we want to see survive and triumph, who we believe in, seeing all these stories about hunting, that she is needing to pick up that rifle and to kill the aggressor, that ultimately this will be a story. I truly believed, until I thought about the fact that I knew James McAvoy was in Glass, that she would have to take out this guy in order to heal. But this movie will not be about her healing.
It's not about healing at all.
Yes.
Yeah.
In fact, it is about identifying with a victim mentality, that people that have been injured have the power to do it to others. And that is what is dicey. The truth of the matter is, the mentally ill are oftentimes more the victims of violence than the perpetrators. But the movies like to paint the other story because it's such easy writing. It's so convenient to say, oh no, if they're crazy, they're gonna get you, and that's their motive, that they're crazy.
And this is what I said back with Hereditary. I was kind of glad that it wasn't, oh, it's mental illness that's the monster, because yeah, that is such a trope and it's not an easy thing to deal with. I'm fine with it though in a B movie like that. Again, I'm giving this film the pass with the multiple personality disorders, but I think there are some troubling implications if you try to look deeper, if you try looking for that A movie material that M. Night says he's bringing.
Yeah, I don't see A movie material here. I'm just going with the trope of, yeah, the crazy. But you know what I thought I would be seeing is the personalities fighting against each other. The good personalities trying to save the girls, the bad personalities trying to keep them there. We never really get any of the good personalities coming out. At no point, and this would be a good tease, I would think, is to have the real Barry show up and be like, hey, I'm going to help get you out. And then at the last minute, Dennis shows up or something.
That is my question, because Karen keeps getting these emails from Barry saying, I need an urgent appointment. Is he getting out for like 3 seconds to be able to send the email? And like, Dennis comes back and he checks the email outbox to see what was sent. And is like, dang it, Barry, now I got to go pretend to be you again.
I guess so. Yeah, they are fighting back, but only through email. They are not trying to help the girls. They don't have the power to do so. The way I take it is the Horde is in control. There's no way that the other 20 personalities can enact any kind of aid for these women that are being held in captivity. They are at the mercy because of Hedwig, really. Hedwig keeps the light on him. He has that power, and he is in cahoots with the two people that believe in his beast and want to see that beast come into power. And so, yeah, there are too many appointments with Karen for Karen to figure it out. She's seen the news. She knows about girl abductions. She knows his history. She believes that the guy who has a history of making girls dance naked and has this potential to abduct them is the one impersonating Barry. It takes her an awfully long time to get in that cab and go see for herself.
This movie's longer than most of M. Night's.
It's his longest one. It's almost 2 hours.
Yeah, and I think he would have been better off at his 90-minute running time. I remember when I first watched this movie, I did watch those deleted scenes. You spurred the memory of that with the romantic bits with Karen, but I think cutting even a little bit more Karen might have been the right way to go and getting a bit more on with it. But I still like the tension. He is keeping tension every scene in this catacomb. And I'm wondering, where are they? There's a kitchen, there's piping and wiring, they're underground.
There's a big wrought iron gate out in front of the place. Yeah, is this an abandoned mansion that he took over? What is this?
Yeah, I think I had figured it out. I mean, that is the big tease, kind of like the village of where's the village really at? And when she goes over the wall, it's meant to be not until the climax of the film where you really realize this is the Philadelphia Zoo. But once Barry, Dennis, whatever he is, goes for a walk, we see that they're far removed from the actual downtown part of Philadelphia. It just kind of looks like a park. And when we saw Hedwig's room, it was filled with animal statues and memorabilia. And he had a walkie-talkie that was connected to what sounded like a security guard. By that point, I knew.
Did Kevin work for the zoo?
Yes. It's a drop line that he was the head maintenance. So he was able to make this safe room out of the eyes of everyone else because he had the power to do so. He had been there for 10 years and never displayed all of this tendency towards abduction. It was a recent idea, I think, put into his head by Hedwig and fueled by his own desire to kidnap little girls.
When the walkie-talkie came out, and it's obviously talking to some security guard, I couldn't remember this from the first viewing. I thought, are they in that stadium where David Dunn did security? Are they in a sporting complex underneath the sporting complex? I mean, that would have made just as much sense as a zoo, really.
The animal part of it. I mean, that was a theme in that room, if you look. And the fact that they're talking about this new personality not being human, but a beast, that it has long fingers and a big mane of hair. And it just sounded like a lion-o.
Yeah, skin as hard as a rhino.
A thundercat. I mean, that's what I'm imagining here. But I know when he's stepping out that he is at the zoo. I didn't know that he was going to pay homage to his dead father and that the reason that the beast was coming that night and no other time is it's the anniversary of the train crash that David Dunn survived. His father died in a train yard.
Is it the same train crash?
Absolutely. If you listen to what Karen said, your father left you. That's why you imagine the beast in your story living in a train yard. We assumed that meant that the father got on a train and went away. But then when he goes and lays yellow flowers down by that Amtrak, I go, oh.
Well, yeah, that's what confused me is because I'm like, oh, is this going to be the same train wreck as Unbreakable? But then he goes to a train station to lay the flowers. I thought he would have gone to where the wreck was to lay those flowers. So I wasn't quite sure.
Yeah, I couldn't follow the whole train thing myself. I thought it might have been some bad metaphor. I didn't realize the father died in that train wreck. Remember, it is said that Kevin Crumb might have been that little kid that David Dunn touched in the train station that day and knew that the mother was abusing, but he chose to go after the guy who'd kidnapped a household of people instead of the abusive mom.
We'll know this weekend, but my theory is overwhelmingly that this guy lost his father in that very same train crash, that glass made him who he is, just as he made David Dunn who he is. All of that pathos is why it's happening this night, because the beast could have come at any time, right? I mean, all he had to do was will it into being and it would be there, but it was the anger of the anniversary and the need to like go shirtless in that train car that sends him over the edge and turns him into full-on animal. And so much so that he passed the sniff test with the security guard dogs. Like, they smell him and think he's a coyote. He no longer moves or resembles a man. He is something else.
And this is where I'm like, okay, this is more M. Night than I wanted. Remember, I got off the M. Night train when it crashed in Unbreakable, and I hadn't seen a film since. I wanted a psychological thriller. I was going to give it the mulligan of multiple personality disorder and go with that and allow him to play with that all he wanted. But the moment Kevin turned into the beast and started climbing on the walls like Spider-Man, I'm like, oh God, you just took the suspense out of this for me. You didn't make him scarier. You made him sillier.
To me, this feels very much in the tradition of Thomas Harris and Red Dragon. I mean, I think it's actually a ripoff of the way that Red Dragon, more so in the remake with Ed Norton than the Manhunter version, but that whole idea was that if I eat the painting, I become the dragon.
Yeah, except here's the thing, because I was thinking Red Dragon throughout this. That is more of a true psychological thriller. That is just a normal guy that's not going to get magical powers from eating a painting. He's crazy, so he thinks he will. It's just a more dramatic film. This one, M. Night, I don't know, maybe it's because he's with Blumhouse, and I'm not complaining necessarily, but it just feels like he has gone full B-movie, and he is not trying to elevate it. But that's fine. Give me a suspenseful thriller about a crazy serial killer. It might work.
No, here's what I would argue, is Night believes this shit.
Oh, no, I agree. I'm waiting for a certain point where it really comes out, though.
Knight believes in destiny and God willing things, and that all you have to do is have an ego. I mean, all Knight needs to do is just say, I'm a banana, and he'll grow a yellow peel. I mean, he is a true convert of mind over matter. He is waiting for science to catch up. It's why Kieran ultimately has to die. Even though he's on her side, she'll end up getting kidnapped, and her knife won't be able to break his skin, and he'll give her the bear hug from behind to kill her. It's because ultimately she says the line, there has to be limits to human potential. No, 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 no. In Knight's mind, you can become the greatest entertainer of all time, and all those critics are just wrong, and they'll be proven wrong in the future when you inspire a president to change the world. I mean, he just is a true believer in himself to a degree that I find really disconnected from reality.
But, and yet I think there is a moment of self-awareness. Like, we find out what is the beast's weakness. Kieran's going to tell us it's not water, surprisingly, in this film. You just got to say Kevin's name.
It's a Rumpelstiltskin thing again.
Yeah.
But I do feel like that's M. Night saying, oh yeah, for the longest time, if you said M. Night, it would take a movie. Like, is this a moment of self-awareness that his weakness was his name at one point, and now he's having a little bit of a bounce back?
No, you and I might see it that way, but Night never saw that his name was sullied. I mean, again, if you hear him even behind the scenes, what he talks about is that the movies that he made previously, they aren't bad. It was that he was a different filmmaker because he was talking to children and that his children were young. And so he was making fairy tales and what have you. This is Knight returning to adulthood. His children are the age of these captive victims now. He's thinking in terms of adult. And that is why there might be a difference between this film and the last five that we've totally trashed. They're not bad. They're just, he was a different person with a different mentality, willing a different sentiment into being. I mean, wake up, dude. It drives me nuts. I'm all for confidence. I understand in order to mount anything, you have to believe in yourself. There's nothing wrong with having the willpower and the drive to see a vision to light. But you made some shit movies, M. Night. Do not lie and say that we lack the mentality to appreciate who you were in the moment.
I hope at least his kids said they liked him because nobody else did.
Yeah. Anyway, let's get to the end of this one because we are headed to the climax and that, yes, there's been a lot of portent about this beast being a sentient creature who represents the highest form of human evolution. And again, it's making me think of Beast X-Men. The fact that it's McAvoy actually adds an extra pomo layer of credibility to the fact that he's becoming superhero. But Arnie, I'm hearing you say, when I finally see the thing, I don't buy it.
Yeah, it's just no. Even now, the problem is, yeah, McAvoy's kind of ripped here, but he's no beast. He's no muscle man.
Yeah, but that almost goes to what you guys are saying, that this could be somewhat all in his head psychological. It's not literally like he morphs into a muscle man.
I actually wondered if that was going to be a twist, too. Is this all in his head? And we'll find out that he is not invincible. But no, this is all real.
When we see him crawling the walls is when I'm like, okay. It's just, I wanted something more grounded, and M. Night went more supernatural.
Have you watched all these M. Night films?
No, I hadn't when I saw this the first time. No!
But it's still a problem for you, and you've watched them all now.
No, I'm explaining how I felt the first time. This time watching it, I know what I'm in for, and I realize the focus of the movie is different. I see this time why he spends so much time with Karen, and I see why the movie is the way it is. But I think this movie has suffered a fatal blow because it was such a suspenseful kidnapping movie. And M. Night didn't want to make that movie, but he was doing a damn good job of it. He stumbled into accidentally making a great film and then fucked it up at the climax by going supernatural.
So all of that, what your conclusion that this movie suddenly sounding like Red Arrow is because he chose to personify a beast.
In an unbelievable way that provided me no emotional closure for two-thirds of the victims. They're killed off screen. Like, we don't even know if they're eaten other than Kevin has some blood around his mouth that he's wiping off and they didn't live. We don't get to see them as survivors.
PG-13, I think, is the main enemy here. It's pretty clear. Casey ultimately watches the video, realizes that whenever the main personality leaves, he keeps the keys on a rack. She's got the keys. She's all ready to go free them all. That's just when the beast comes back and is eating the girl we thought would be, in a typical horror movie, really the last girl. I mean, she was the fighter. She was the one that takes on Freddy or Jason or what have you. The passive ones traditionally have always been the ones that get eradicated. It's only if you fight for yourself that you survive. The twist here is that no, it's this person that accepts her role as being the victim that doesn't get hurt.
But she is going to become more active because she's going to go in that room that Karen was in and find out Kevin's full name and Rumpelstiltskin that thing all up. And the beast is going to go away for a little bit. And this is the first time we actually see Kevin. And he goes, I got a shotgun. Go get it and kill me. And she does that. Like, she is taking an active role at this point.
Well, she does everything except the last part. She cannot kill him with that shotgun, but she definitely goes and tries to stave him off. At the very least, she ends up finding a cage. More clues to the fact that she's in a zoo is that there's this private cage off somewhere in the ductwork here, and he's able to bend the bars and come to them. It's possible. It is possible in a reality that a human being could do this. He is not a beast. He is someone with a bunch of adrenaline in him that you hear about the kid that's endangered under the car and the mom lifting up the car to protect the kid. I mean, I think that Knight is still trying to keep it in the realm of these are real human beings.
Well, until he takes 3 shotgun blasts and lives.
Yes, until the shotgun blast, you can say that everything he does is within the realm of a mind that
No. The climbing the ceiling.
The ceiling is definitely possible. Look at the ceiling. It's modeled. It's not flat. There is lots of ridges and curves to the stone.
He's a hell of a mountain climber then.
Part of the myth of that beast is that it has the ability and its claws to be able to manipulate such a surface.
What about when Karen stabs him with a knife and because of his rhino thick skin, the knife breaks instead of stabbing him?
All right, you're right. That's superhuman. Maybe she hit the wrong part. Maybe it's the belt buckle. I don't know. We never saw where the knife went in, but I agree. I'm stretching here.
Stop helping him, Knight.
I'm trying to help his little myth making. He's trying to do what Nolan did. You know, Nolan had a great way of looking at superheroes and saying, well, here's an origin that can kind of explain how we might get such a wild personality into our reality. And here, Knight's not as good as that, but he is trying. And I do think until the shotgun blast, we believe that everything that this character could be done by someone that is driven wild like an animal.
No, I never believed that. So when you say we, I do not ever believe that. The moment he turned into the beast, my suspension of disbelief went out the window.
See, I have no problem with the beast. Here's my biggest problem with this film is the big reveal. The beast looks upon Casey and sees she has scars and goes, oh, you're one of the blessed ones. Because of your abuse, you deserve to live. One, I do think, I was hesitant to say it in Lady in the Water, I do think M. Night is maybe mentally ill, because I have seen this going to group therapies and that kind of thing. There is kind of this ownership when you don't want to take your medication that, no, I'm different. I need this depression. It lets me see things the real way in life. And this abuse has let me to see the real world. I've taken the red pill and I see things as they are. This is a thing to go through therapy, get on medication. You start to see things more logically. But the fact that you're going to say, oh, only if you have been sexually abused, do you deserve to live? Do you understand how the world is? You could not get abused and still understand how the world really works. And it is because there's not the giddiness of a midnight movie here, and it's M. Night trying to be serious. I just have problems with some of the implications, like the way this end speech could be taken by the beast.
The shock is she's not a hero. We thought this was a story about overcoming, and in fact, I mean, she does pull the trigger on the gun, but it doesn't work. She doesn't kill the beast, metaphorically or not, and when she's rescued,
she's gonna go back to her uncle, maybe?
We don't know if she's gonna go back with her abuser or not. I mean, again, it's shocking. I mean, I hear from you, you're angry about that. I just think it's a bold choice to show a passive character that is comfortable in her abuse. That we do not see triumph is a shock. It's unprecedented, really.
It's also a complete lack of a character arc for anyone other than the beast.
Well, let me put it this way. She's the character I'm most excited to see when we get to Glass. I can't wait to see what she's done. More than David Dunn or the beast, how did she process everything that she went through?
She's coming back?
Yeah, she's one of the stars. She's in the trailer.
Did not know.
Huh. I didn't notice her in the trailer, but I'm saying this shouldn't be done. I'm just saying M. Night's not the person to do it. I just don't think he has the grasp on reality. I mean, this could be triggering for people to say, oh no, you're special because you were sexually molested and you're only able to deal with the world if your uncle touched you and that you might go back to your uncle. This isn't the movie that's going to be able to tackle something that heady.
It makes me really uncomfortable that he says, I'm out for the untouched, when quite literally she had the bad uncle touch thing going on.
Yeah, I mean, again, they're drawing those parallels between them. Here's the thing. I think you're making the assumption that M. Night is condoning this.
I don't know if he's condoning it. I'm just saying someone that has gone through this could be very troubled by it.
Imagine for a second, all of this movie was in the storyline of Unbreakable, that it's all one film. So we're seeing one person that was a victim and they went the wrong way. And then we see one person that is going to become a hero. I think the story becomes more balanced. And then caught in the middle is this female character who we're not sure where she's going to land in all this. She could end up becoming a superheroine, or she could end up being destroyed because of this.
And maybe Glass will clear this all up. I'm saying you take this as a film, as we often try to do, even though we do franchises. Does this work as a standalone film? It's got troubling implications. That's all I'm saying. I'm not saying it ruins the film. I'm just saying, viewer beware.
It certainly is more provocative than we're used to in this kind of movie. And yeah, it's hard to trust Knight to be someone that is careful and balanced in dealing with touchy subject matter. I agree that he's not someone that I think of as being the most adept writer. Because he stops here, all we can do is ask questions. Glass will provide the answers.
But when I saw this movie the first time, I wasn't sure, even if it was in that universe, there was certainly no guarantee of a sequel when I saw it, even though there were talks.
Yeah, I didn't believe it at the time. I heard the rumors that Bruce Willis was in this and they were going to reboot it, and I went, yeah, right, like they're going to go back to Unbreakable. No way are they ever going to do this. It just seemed to me like a tease to something we would never get, that they actually get the trip-hop beat of Unbreakable. The score suddenly becomes something entirely different when we cut to the diner and the news is unveiling the gruesome details. The whole reason the Horde is the way that he is that he modeled his latest personality on the zoo lions. And doesn't this sound just like that crazy guy from 15 years ago? What was his name? Oh, Bruno. That's right.
Let's find out how excited we are. Jacob, Stuart, do you recommend Split? Jacob.
Despite my hesitancy with some of the implications at the end, just like with Signs, pretty decent film until you get to the last 10 minutes and then M. Night's all over it. I think he does that a little bit here. Just not the person I want to see take on moral ambiguity. But as a supernatural thriller, yeah, it's all right. It held my interest this time, even though it's his longest one. I found a lot of things to grab onto with this silly idea of this multiple personality disorder as the way they show it in this film, the idea of the waiting room and all that. I kind of like some of that mythology that was built. I think this is one of his better looking films, his best looking in a long time. You know, there's a shot from the top down. You see a street lamp like dividing the screen and the beast run by. Just a lot of little interesting shots like that. I think this is that old M. Night kind of returning, where I'm seeing visual things in the story that are just not totally laughable. There are funny things in here. Whenever Hedwig comes out, I'm laughing. When he does that dance, it's hilarious. But no, this is a much more competent M. Night. I could give this a recommend.
Stuart.
Yeah, I don't know that it's Knight's best film, but it might be his most sane. I mean, it's the only one that doesn't have a plot twist so stupid I scream. It's the only one that doesn't excessively monologue or have a third act that it just races through. I feel like the climax is just the right length. If anything, the movie's a little long, but, you know, we've been complaining that Knight is all first act and no third act. This movie works as a standalone B-movie thriller. I'd never call it genius, but you know, when viewing his filmography selectively, it's part of the four good ones that I recommend. I have no problem saying that this is on the same level as Sixth Sense, Unbreakable, a little bit better than The Visit. It is a comeback. The man managed to get back to where he was in 1999. I was never sold that it was Hitchcock or Spielberg, but it's a nice place to be. And if he can keep it up with Glass, then maybe this journey will have been worth it. Maybe all this pain we've suffered, all these scars on my body, having watched all these films again, will heal.
You're right. This is definitely a comeback. And I could sniff it. I could tell from the not shitty Rotten Tomatoes scores and things that this was one where, okay, I'll give you a little bit of a chance here, M. Night. I'm not going to go to theaters, but I'll watch it on video on demand. And it's close. It is close to a recommend. Now, keep in mind, I'm really on the borderline on Unbreakable. I eked over into the weakest of recommends for our review. The first time I saw it, it was a not recommend because it blueballed at the end. And here, it's the same thing. It's an ending problem, but it's so close. It's a competent film with characters I like and actors that give good performances across the board. It's just that it's a bit overly long. It spends too much time trying to justify its crazy twist at the end. And the only way it quote-unquote justifies it is by having a quote-unquote expert just monologuing about it for a half an hour of the movie. I wish there was more of Kevin and his personalities and more of Casey and Claire and Marcia and less of Karen.
I got a fix for you. It's something I dream. Maybe it exists on YouTube. What if somebody fan edited Split and Unbreakable? Wouldn't that be the best thing? If it were 1 2-hour 15 minutes, I think you could get the best of both movies in, and it would be really taut, exciting, and thrilling to watch both arcs happening at the same time.
I agree. And it would also help contextualize this film. You have to understand a big problem here is for an hour and a half, we had Silence of the Lambs. We had Red Dragon, which never ended with Jamie Gum climbing on the walls.
Well, Red Dragon became the Red Dragon. I mean, Ralph Fiennes certainly ate that painting.
I prefer the Tom Noonan version, the Michael Mann film. But even Hannibal Lecter and Jamie Gum never ended up crawling on walls. And as we see in the trailer for Glass, flipping cars over.
Okay, you are literally red-arrowing this movie because of one shot of him climbing the wall.
No, and everything that comes after.
It's so weird that when this goes superhero, that's what makes you poo-poo it.
Like, because I wanted and had a good thriller, and it turned out not to be.
It couldn't be a supernatural thriller. It couldn't have a monster in it. You don't like thrillers that go supernatural?
And again, I'd argue nothing here is that supernatural except the shotgun blast. Maybe she missed. I don't know. We never saw if she got good at deer hunting.
He's picking Buck out at the end of the film.
Yeah.
And the knife, and I don't care who you are. I guess there's one guy in China who can climb those buildings. They call him the Spider-Man, and he climbs buildings without any scaffolding. But it's so close. But it, again, like Unbreakable, blue balls me at the end. So I'm going to red arrow it. But I'm strangely excited for Glass because I do think that McAvoy did a great job. I think the Horde is an interesting concept. And if you don't have him in a kidnap murder thriller, and instead you put him in this superhero team up, I'm wanting a film M. Night will never make. I'm excited for M. Night's Avengers, and what I'm going to walk out with may end with, after 3 hours of them sitting in a room together talking to a doctor, a pop-up title of "They Never Got Out."
You're going
to
get a freeze frame, and David Dunn brought him to justice.
Yes, I mean, that could be what I'm in for. I'm setting myself up for letdown, but I'm excited.
Well, here's the thing to realize. One, Night has a bigger budget. Some of what you may have wanted wouldn't have been possible on $9 million here in Split. But now he certainly has the more confidence with all the money that Split made. He has the ability to make another big film again. And you're right. The teases I've seen in that trailer lead me to believe there's going to be big moves. That the Beast, at least, is going to be doing some cool things. What am I hearing you say? You want more superhero or you want it to be plausible?
This movie was set up to be plausible.
I get that. You felt tricked. It's the same problem you have with that magician movie with Hugh Jackman that Nolan made. I mean, I get it. You don't forgive the twist.
I could put it this way. At least with Unbreakable, that was a deconstruction of the superhero. Split, it's not a deconstruction of the supervillain. It's just a supernatural thriller that is now getting put into this universe that M. Night's created. I don't think Glass is going to be deconstruction of superheroes again. But yeah, it might be pulpy B-movie fun. M. Night is showing me he could do that again with this film.
Yeah, I don't know what else he could say. His characters have said so much about potential and all of this. And frankly, I'm tired of hearing it. I'm like, Night, don't you just realize you had overbearing parents that told you you had to be the greatest too long? And now every movie you make is about someone becoming the greatest. Drop all that shit and have a fight scene. And this film might be the one, more than Airbender or any of the other ones, to finally be a combat film. It would be really interesting to see him try.
There was no fight scenes in Airbender.
I cannot wait to see the 63-year-old Bruce Willis and the 69-year-old Sam Jackson get into a punching match. It's like Bum Fights, the movie hero edition.
Yeah, you don't have to be made out of glass to watch those bones snap. But through the powers of special effects, I'm sure they'll look cooler than they actually would in real life.
Can I go all in betting on 39-year-old McAvoy against those two geezers?
Again, the character I'm most excited about is Casey. I really want to know how her story ends. It's the only one I can't predict.
I'm still holding out for Haley Joel to return with his Army of the Dead.
We'll have to see. But you know what? Strangely enough, this is the most excited I've been for a Night movie in quite some time.
In a good way, not because it looks awful.
Agreed. It's the most excited I've been since Unbreakable, when I was like, Marjorie, we have to go see Unbreakable. We have to go see it opening weekend. I am not dreading seeing Glass. And I feel like if nothing else, even if I don't like it, at least we're in the land of respectable movies again. At least I don't feel like I'm walking in and M. Night's going to be there with pins in his head. I have such sights to show you. And then I'm going to be sitting in a theater for 2 hours with hooks in my flesh the way I was in Lady in the Water and Happening.
As much as I've enjoyed mocking the hubris that Night so flagrantly shows in his worst films, I am rooting for him. I always am. I ultimately really do want people to do well and to succeed. And it would be nice for someone that has such belief that he's great to actually deliver something that was great. He hasn't made a great film in my mind. Maybe this could be the one.
I have one final question, though. So the guy who's helping Karen and eating the Hooters in this movie, did he used to be a drug dealer that David Dunn scared 15 years ago? And if M. Night has a cameo in the next movie, is it still that character's evolution?
No, Arnie, clearly he's got a split personality as well. We know that. That motherfucker.
He's willing himself into different jobs and everything. Yeah.
Yeah, he's had a lot of different hats, and hopefully the least crazy one will show up next week.
Well, we'll find out. Donors, thank you for coming back and being with us. I think these are probably 3 of the 4 most anticipated movie reviews of the series. The Eastrail Trilogy plus Sixth Sense. So thank you for your support. Thank you for joining us. We'll be back next week with our first theatrical review release of 2019. And now it's time for us to split.
It has begun. Tell me something, David. When you woke up this morning, was it still there? The sadness?
No.
I think this is where we shake hands.
Once again, thank you for supporting Now Playing, and we hope you've enjoyed this bonus movie review.
Now, we'd like a PB and J sandwich.
Your support helps keep Now Playing on the air.
You made that decision, and I find that very, very interesting. Now all I need is your credit card number.
The opinions expressed on Now Playing are those of the individual hosts and may not reflect the opinion of Venganza Media Incorporated.
I'm telling on you.
I'll tell you something. And you can tell me if I'm lying or not, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Like a test.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Venganza Media Incorporated is not affiliated with, and this podcast has not been prepared, approved, or licensed by any entity that created the film analyzed herein.
You should never do anything like this. You know that, right?
Yeah.
What do you do if something bad happens?
Get Mom.
All movie clips and music included in this podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purpose of review, and no infringement is intended.
Yeah.
It is more dramatic than that. They are what they believe they are. The brain has learned to defend itself.
Now Playing Podcast is an exclusive trademark of and may not be used without the express written permission of Enganza Media Incorporated.
You can't let bad things happen to good people, right? That's your code, right? That's the hero's code.
Now Playing is a Enganza Media production, copyright 2019. And no part of this show may be reproduced, repurposed, or redistributed without the written permission of Enganza Media Incorporated. All rights reserved.
I hope this makes you feel calm. You will be in the presence of something greater.
Hedwig might let them go. Hedwig is...
It's Hedwig, really. I mean, it's not...
Yeah, no. They say it as Hedwig throughout the film.
Okay. Hedwig...
It's a weird pronoun. Yeah.
Hedwig might let them go. I think Hedwig might be the owl from Harry Potter now that I think about it.
I mean, Hedwig and the Angry Inch. You ever saw that? It's Hedwig. That crazy guy from 15 years ago. What was his name? Oh, Bruno. That's right.
Coming right up.
People may not remember, but yes, Bruce Willis had a musical alter ego named Bruno.
Oh, yeah.
I have both albums, and I listen to The Return of Bruno all the time. It's on YouTube, the video of it.
Of course.
He does some good rock and roll in there. Coming right up, and Express Yourself, and Secret Asian Man. And
see, so if listeners have been wondering why he keeps praising Bruce Willis in these movies, it's because he's completely brainwashed.
Yeah, you don't buy McAvoy as the Beast, but Bruce Willis is a rock and roller.
Yeah.
Oh, come on. It all started with Seagrams. Golden wine, cool Seagrams.
Yeah, I remember those. Yep, the 80s were painful.
It's wet and it's dry. Golden wine, cool. And he sang all the time, Woolly Bully, and There She Comes, just walking down the street and moonlighting.
He sang all the time if you let him, if you bought the album and played it. It wasn't like it was all over MTV.
You know, he still shows up at clubs and goes on stage and sings and plays harmonica.
I'll be missing that.
He's quite a good singer.
I'm glad you enjoyed that.
But I enjoy it better than any acting he has done in the past 15 years.